Iowa landowners who don't want their property used for the Bakken pipeline have decided to sue the Iowa Utilities Board. More on that story this hour. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury, in for Ben Kiefer. This week, Sally Mason retires as president of the University of Iowa, the Board of Regents throw their support behind an increase in college tuition, and the Hinterland Festival is forced to find a new venue as their original location, Waterworks Park in Des Moines, is flooded. We'll have updates on these stories and more coming up after this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River. I'm Emily Woodbury, in for Ben Kiefer. Coming up later in the show, I'll talk with an elite Muslim athlete who learned to ride a bike to participate in this year's Rag Rye. Also, Iowa Public Radio's Dean Borg reports on Sally Mason's retirement today, as well as the Board of Regents' proposal to increase tuition. Now I'm joined by Iowa Public Radio reporter Sarah Bowden, who's following an update on the Bakken pipeline conflict. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Emily.
So, take us back a step. What is the proposal for the Bakken pipeline in Iowa, and how is the company attempting to gain access to Iowa land?
Right. So as I'm sure a lot of our listeners know, the Bakken pipeline is the proposed pipeline would start in North Dakota, and the Bakken oil fields go through South Dakota, diagonally cross Iowa from the north western to the southeastern portion of the state, and then go into Illinois, and it would cross 18 counties, is I believe the number. To build this pipeline, it would cross a lot of farmland, and so Energy Transfer Partners is in the process of obtaining voluntary easements from landowners, and last I checked with them, they say they have roughly 61% of the necessary easements.
Meaning that 60% of landowners said, okay, you can run this through?
Roughly 61% of landowners say, yeah, exactly. So this is taking a lot of time, obviously, because some people are saying, yeah, sure, whatever. And other landowners are saying, under no circumstances will I ever grant you right to my land. And other landowners are saying, well, maybe I could entertain that possibility, but what you're offering me isn't enough.
Do we know what they're offering?
Well, what they're offering is the fair market value, which would be determined by an independent panel. However, what the landowners are saying is they'd only be offered the fair market value for the portion that the pipeline touches. So it wouldn't be for the whole property, but let's say the pipeline touches 4% of their property, it would just be 4% of the land that would be fair market value. And landowners are saying this pipeline really compromises my land. It exposes it to flooding. Landowners are saying that it raises the temperature of the land, which then affects agriculture. Also, they're saying that because an easement continues with the property in perpetuity, so that means that it doesn't expire and you have to go through legal action to take away the easement, essentially. So if they were to sell their property at a future date, that would lessen the value of the property because then the future landowner would also have to abide by the easement. So they're saying that it's not a good deal financially for them.
So a group of Iowa landowners are suing the Iowa Utilities Board, and they're saying it's an effort to protect their property from eminent domain. So what exactly are they claiming as they're suing the Iowa Utilities Board?
Right. So eminent domain in Iowa is somewhat limited to utilities, and the Bakken pipeline has applied with the Iowa Utilities Board to put in this pipeline. The landowners are saying, well, crude oil isn't a utility because it's not produced in Iowa, or it's not taken from Iowa, it's not used by Iowans, and there are no crude oil refineries in Iowa. It's simply a pipeline that goes through Iowa into Illinois. So it's not a utility, and therefore eminent domain, it cannot be applicable in this situation.
And I could imagine if something went wrong, if you know the pipeline was compromised, that then more of the land could be affected.
Exactly.
So you mentioned that the landowners are saying the utilities board, the state's utilities board, has no authority to grant eminent domain because you know, this oil is not a utility provided to Iowans from Iowa land. Does the law support this?
I mean, that's why they're going to court, because they're asking the court to give clarification. Does the Iowa Utilities Board actually have the right to grant eminent domain in this situation, or does it not? Because then that really affects the landowner's ability to bargain. Because what they're saying is that Dakota Access, which is the LLC who's in its parent company is Energy Transfer, they're saying Dakota Access agents are saying, if you don't do this easement right now, we're going to have to go to eminent domain, and you're not going to like that, and you're not going to win. And so what they're saying is, we need to know if we actually have the ability to negotiate, or if we have no power at all. Mm-hmm. And so that's why they have filed this lawsuit. Also, what the landowners are essentially asking the court to do is define what is a utility. Is crude oil a utility? Is it a utility if you're taking the material and it's just traveling through the state and it's not stopping in the state? These are all kind of interesting questions that I could see going to the state Supreme Court eventually.
Well, we should say the Iowa Utilities Board has not made a decision yet whether eminent domain will apply in this case. You know, so do we know why the landowners would choose to file a lawsuit before that decision comes down?
Well, they want to, like I said, they want to know if they have negotiating power, or if, you know, eminent domain is just going to happen and they just might as well sign the easement. They want to know how much power they have to negotiate in the situation. And some landowners have said, or one landowner in particular said, you know, I feel threatened because, you know, they're threatening me with eminent domain, and I want to know if this is essentially an empty threat, if I could paraphrase.
Mm-hmm. When's a decision coming down from the board?
A hearing is tentatively scheduled from November 12th through December 2nd, according to the Des Moines Register, and that hearing will then consider Energy Transfer's application for the pipeline. So, again, what the landowners are doing is trying to be one step ahead maybe and say, you know, it doesn't matter what the utility board actually decides in this case, because they don't have power to decide whether or not this pipeline can be built, because again, crude oil is not a utility.
All right, we'll continue to follow this story as it develops. Iowa Public Radio's Sarah Bowden, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Emily.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury, in for Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow, University of Iowa President Sally Mason retires after 8 years in office. Classes resume August 24th, so acting as interim president, the university's vice president for medical affairs, Jean Robillard, will take Mason's place. Meanwhile, the search for a new president is on. The deadline for applications is today. Here with me to talk about the process for her replacement is Iowa Public Radio correspondent Dean Borg. Hi, Dean.
Good afternoon, Emily.
Good afternoon. So how is the search going?
It seems to be going along just as the recipe was prescribed. I sat in and listened in, I should say, on a telephone conference call with the Parker search firm president, Lori Wilder, speaking from her office in Atlanta, I presume. And she was speaking with the members of the search committee. I don't really know how many of those, maybe 15 to or so members. And they're laying out the prescription for the next few weeks, and expect to have a president appointed at the Board of Regents meeting on September 4th.
And we actually have a clip from Lori Wilder.
There are 44 individuals who have submitted their materials for consideration, and we have approximately six additional potential candidates that are still in the process of making that final decision. Some of those candidates have indicated to us, again, confidentiality and the importance of that, and they're still not ready to submit that to this full search committee.
So, Dean, we might not even have all of the applicants, or even the future president of the University of Iowa might not have applied yet.
Isn't that interesting? Because Lori Wilder, at least twice during that conversation, said, it's not over until it's over. And what you're alluding to is Lori Wilder saying there are people who are so fearful of having the publicity about them being considered, because they don't want their current employer to know, that some of them aren't even sending letters of application. What they're doing is sending their credentials, because if they have to later deny, "I was interested in this job," they can.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dean, how much do we know about these applicants? I'm sure they come from all different types of backgrounds, but what are some of the qualifications that would make a candidate for the president of the University of Iowa?
Well, certainly, and in the past, there have been, you know, discussions about maybe we should have a business person, not a university background or experienced person or an academic, but maybe someone who's experienced in business, because and the regents in recent years have also appointed people who are very adept and have a good fundraising record. And so that's very, very important as it relates to the way that universities are financed now.
Mm-hmm. When can we expect a decision to be made?
Well, here's the timetable. Tuesday, August 4th, next Tuesday, the search committee meets with the Parker search firm at the University of Iowa, and they will then winnow the candidates who have submitted by then, understanding it's not over till it's over. And they have been asked to, number one, put in piles definitely out, definitely in, and intriguing, but I want more information, those categories. Then August 11th to the 12th, they will meet with the winnowed group at airport interviews in Chicago. August 31st through September 3rd, those candidates, the finalists, will be visiting on campus at the University of Iowa. And September 4th at the Regents' meeting, they'll be interviewed by the Regents and make a final selection.
It's not over till it's over. Well, Dean, you follow other higher education news, and recently the Iowa Board of Regents, they called for a 3% tuition increase to go in effect halfway through the 2016-2017 academic year, or the 2015-2016, rather, academic year. This would be the first ever mid-year tuition hike, and it would end the tuition freeze that's been in place for the last 2.5 years. You know,
yes.
The fact that it's a mid-year change is significant, because the board originally had this freeze in place the whole year. What happened?
Well, here's what happened. Last December, the Regents said we're going to freeze tuition for the next school year, and that would have included this coming fall semester and into the spring semester. They were anticipating, in fact, they'd asked the General Assembly for a 4.3% or nearly $22 million increase in their appropriations for the three state universities. They didn't get it. Instead of $21.7 million, the General Assembly appropriated $6.5 million, and Governor Branstad also, there was some one-time money that had been appropriated, and he vetoed that. And so the Regents were wound up with a lot less than they had anticipated, and they were trying to finance the next school year with a lot less state appropriation. So when the legislature had adjourned and that it was going to be short, Bruce Rastetter, the Regents president, said we can't spring this on students for the fall semester, but we'll have to reconsider the spring, and that's what they are doing now.
What kind of effect do we know this could have on students?
Well, it's going to be about at least a $100 increase for most students. Some undergraduate students, and these are Iowa students, this does not apply to out-of-state tuition, but some at the University of Iowa who are in nursing, medicine, engineering, and so on, they'll have bigger increases. The most increase is $134 for business students and nursing students. At Iowa State, engineers are up 133, and the University of Northern Iowa has only one category, and that's the business upper division resident students, and their tuition goes up $123.
Mm. I'm thinking of what we were just talking about when we were talking about the University of Iowa president. It's not over till it's over. The Board of Regents is going to make a final vote on this at the beginning of September. Is there anything that could happen between now and then to change the outcome?
I don't think so. The only thing is, it's not over till it's over. We keep saying that, but and as you said earlier, the next president of the University of Iowa may not even have the credentials in. He or she may not even have the credentials submitted yet.
All right, Dean Borg, Iowa Public Radio correspondent. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Emily.
Take care. Thanks for joining us for a News Buzz edition of River to River on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury, in for Ben Kiefer. Some tragic news from Northwest Iowa this week. In the town of Cylinder, a father and son were overwhelmed by fumes from a hog manure pit. This is the second instance in the Midwest this month of a father and son death due to poisonous manure pit gases. Gene Opheim and his son, Austin Opheim, were rescued from the pit on Saturday, but both were pronounced dead at a hospital in Emmitsburg. Here with me to talk about the dangers of this type of work is Dan Anderson. He's an assistant professor of agricultural and biosystems engineering at Iowa State University. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Emily. How are you?
Good, good. Sad news coming out of Cylinder. What exactly happened that day? How did this happen?
Well, anytime manure is stored, it is going to release some gases, and those could include things like ammonia, carbon dioxide, methane, and hydrogen sulfide. Hydrogen sulfide is heavier than air. It tends to accumulate down near that manure surface. So anytime an activity takes part where we're very close to that manure or disturbing that manure surface, some of these gases come off, and if the conditions are right, they can overwhelm us and potentially have deadly consequences.
Mm-hmm. And even overwhelm the person trying to rescue the first person, which is what happened in this case.
Absolutely. That's something, unfortunately, we see in a lot of cases. I think our instinct is when we see someone that needs help, we want to jump in. But in cases like this where it's our oxygen is compromised, there's poisonous gases in the air, oftentimes the rescuer can't survive in those conditions either, and it just doesn't work out for us to do that sort of thing.
Is this a really common occurrence?
It's not common. It's relatively rare. We've seen 4 or 5 incidences over the last 4 or 5 years, so it's not infrequent, but it's not something we see often.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned you don't want to just jump in, even though that might be your instinct to just jump in and save a person. What could a person do if they saw someone in this type of accident to prepare themselves, to have a successful rescue?
Well, I think a lot of it comes down to preparation before we're doing this type of activity, being mindful of the environment that we're going into. In this case, it was a sump outside the building where the person had some maintenance to do. They dropped a tool down and wanted to retrieve it. Obviously, if we're in a confined space and there's manure down there, there's a chance for hazardous conditions. So before we even go down there, we'd prefer to greatly ventilate out that space and try and get rid of a lot of those gases. And I would encourage some sort of breathing apparatus, whether that be an oxygen supply you take with you or something similar to that if you're going into that situation. But as far as preparing to rescue, if you do go down in there, I would advise tying safety harnesses equipment so that if something should go wrong, we can pull them back rather than having to go down after them.
Mm. So you work within the Agricultural and Biosystems Engineering Department at Iowa State. You specifically look at ways that we can make farming safer?
My area of work is mostly in manure management, so its safety is related to manure. There's some other specialists on campus who deal primarily with safety, and I work in collaboration with them.
Well, when it comes to working with manure, what are some other, engineering, devices or, things that you're working on to make this type of work safer?
Well, a lot of it comes down to sort of designing our manure system. And in this case, it was a system where there was a sump that the manure drained into and it pumped into a different spot. But we look at alternative building designs or alternative ways of treating or storing our manure before these things happen. So that could be things like solid separation, nutrient removal, and how that impacts the manure properties and the ability for it to lose these gases in different situations.
Well, our condolences to the family and friends of Gene and Austin Opheim. Thank you, Dan, for helping us understand this tragedy and hopefully prevent future ones.
I agree.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. Here with me now is Sam Summers. He's the co-owner of Woolies in Des Moines and organizer of the Hinterland Music Festival. We spoke with Sam a few weeks ago as planning for the first time festival was underway. Now organizers and Sam are busy relocating the event as the original location, Waterworks Park, is flooded. Sam, thank you for joining me today. I'm pretty sure you have a very busy schedule right now.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah, things are hectic down here, but they're all kind of coming into place here, you know.
So what's going on? The original venue had flooded.
Yeah, so, you know, originally we had scheduled for Waterworks Park, which is, you know, beautiful venue in Des Moines there, you know, and Mother Nature didn't really cooperate like it had historically in late July. And we got the torrential downpour a couple nights ago, which seems about 2 weeks ago. It raised the river quicker than, you know, it normally does. So they evacuated the park right before we loaded in. So, you know, I had my backup plan in place and we kind of just put everything in motion and everybody around me just started moving so quick and worked so much to get it done.
Yeah, only a few days to go. I mean, where are you relocating the festival to?
So we moved it down to St. Charles, which is 24 minutes drive from Waterworks Park. St. Charles at the Avenue of the Saints Amphitheater, right off the interstate. It's a nice natural bowl amphitheater, you know, right off the highway there that can accommodate the crowd that we're expecting. You know, it's a beautiful space, and I think the people that are coming to the festival that were coming to Waterworks because of, you know, you know, what's around it and the trees and the field and that kind of stuff. We're going to get that same sort of experience down here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I wonder, with a brand new music festival, as this is the first year of Hinterland, there's surely a lot that you can take away from the first experience. Are you already taking away some ideas and thoughts for next time?
Yeah, I mean, you just have to be conscious of, you know, I mean, we made historical data this year with the rain and what came down in late July. I mean, the amount of rain that came down was, I think, the most since 1892 in that period of time. So it's just when you know that sort of information, it kind of helps you base future decisions off of that. And, you know, those are things we'll consider for future years of the festival.
Mm. What is the future of Hinterland? Do we know yet?
Yep. So it'll be an annual festival. I actually had already had a meeting here set up with Avenue of the Saints for next year and beyond, you know, for hosting Hinterland. So it kind of works out. I mean, this was our backup location for this year, but also looking forward, it was something that we were looking at and going to consider very closely.
Mm-hmm. We have some music to end this half today before we're back with more of River to River. Old Crow Medicine Show is playing Saturday night. Are you pretty excited about that?
Oh, definitely. I've been listening to Old Crow for the last, you know, 12 years or whatever here. And over the last year, I've probably listened to every record, you know, 100 times. So I'm looking forward to it. Can't wait.
Sam Summers, co-owner of Woolies in Des Moines and organizer of the Hinterland Music Festival. Thanks, Sam, and good luck. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. Yep.
This is Sweet Amarillo by Old Crow Medicine Show.
Well, the world's greatest wonder, from what I can tell, is how a cowgirl like you could ever look my way. I was blinded by glory with a half-written story. A song spilling out off of every page. Sweet Amarillo, tears on my pillow. You never will know how much I cried. Sweet Amarillo.
That is Sweet Amarillo by Old Crow Medicine Show, playing at the Hinterland Music Festival Saturday night. Coming up in the second half of River to River, I'll talk with Mara Gubwan and Rara Maharik. They're part of the Ragrai team Shirzanan. Raha is an elite Muslim athlete who learned how to bike ride for Ragrai. That's coming up on River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury, in for Ben Kiefer. Ragrai, or the Register's annual Great Bicycle Ride across Iowa, finished last week. And as the stories from the ride come in, there's one in particular that caught our attention. To celebrate their 50th birthdays, native Iowan Mara Gubwan and her Urbandale High School classmates chose not just to ride Ragbri, but to invite six Muslim female athletes along for the ride. Mara's here with me now, as well as Raha Moharik, who came to Iowa from Saudi Arabia for the week-long event. Mara and Raha, thank you both for joining me today.
Hello. Yes, hello, and thank you, Emily. We're happy to be here.
Thank you for having me.
Hello. So you both were part of Team Shirzanan. Team Shirzanan, you went the whole week on Ragbri. First, I want to come to you, Mara. How did you come up with this idea?
Well, as you mentioned in the introduction, my friends and I are turning 50 years old. We wanted to find a physical challenge and something that was socially relevant. So we combined our personal pursuit with my nonprofit initiative, and that's called Shirzanon Global, which is a media and advocacy platform empowering Muslim female athletes. So what I did was I suggested that we bring over one of my advisors who had been working with a cycling team, but it evolved, and instead we decided upon inviting elite Muslim female athletes. And the reason that there were six athletes that we invited is because that six Urbandale classmates committed to the ride for the full week. So we matched each other up six and six.
And what did you hope to get out of this experience?
Well, it was also a combination that we'd be joining forces to promote a global awareness campaign, which is promoting female sports participation as a fundamental right. So as Iowans, we grew up taking for granted the right to safe spaces and access to sport, whereas with many Muslim-majority countries and certainly countries around the world, not necessarily Muslim majority, women face a lot of restrictions, various barriers in terms of gender, culture, etc. And we just wanted to use this platform to promote the fact that we believe all females deserve the right to participate in sport and also the benefits that stem from participation.
Mm-hmm. And Raha, you know what Mara just said better than anyone. You grew up in Saudi Arabia, ranks pretty low on the World Economic Forum Gender Gap Index. To you, you know, what does it mean to be a female athlete from Saudi Arabia?
Oh, I never set out to be this person, but I ended up being, I call myself an accidental role model. I grew up not having role models in the Arab world. And one day I stumbled upon mountain climbing and I fell in love with it. And as I pursued my passion for mountaineering and adventures, I ended up becoming this person. So it was very important for us to bring this topic to life, because a lot of people, like Mara said, a lot of people aren't aware of it. A lot of people don't know that some countries it's illegal, not just not accepted. Bicycles were illegal in Saudi for me. So it means the world to me that this is, we're shedding light on a topic like this. I can't imagine my life without sports.
Mm-hmm. And you're being pretty modest. I mean, you're a renowned mountain climber. You climbed Mount Everest back in 2013, which would be a feat for anyone. But, you know, someone coming from where you came, that was a really big deal.
It was the most difficult part, as hard as Everest was, and I've done a few other mountains, I've done a total of 14, actually convincing my family to accept this as a hobby and now as a career was more difficult than any of the mountains, because I come from a culture where they barely accept females doing things that are slightly independent, let alone something as severe and very macho as high altitude mountain climbing. So it was such a mini battle for me to get them on board. And a lot of people don't realize that in our culture, if you don't get your family on board, you're on your own. It's not like here in the States where you can do your thing and you're still accepted. No, it's you either get them on board or you won't be able to go far, unfortunately.
And did you get them on board?
It took a moment. It took a few mountains. It took a few arguments. But in the end, passion won. They saw how much I loved it. They saw I took time off of my social life. I didn't go to weddings. I missed my own birthday. I was stuck in Antarctica at some point. And they saw the passion. They saw I would wake up in the morning and train. And you can't see that and say, no, you're meant to get married at 25 or whatever age they wanted me to get married at. So in the end, they bless my parents for opening their eyes and seeing, okay, so she's not the typical girl. They didn't fight it in the end. They tried to understand it, and that's a huge testament to how this can change, this mentality of girls not being able to do sport can change. If my parents are now my biggest supporters, I'm sure there are other parents out there too.
You mentioned how in Saudi Arabia it's actually illegal for a woman to ride a bike.
Yes, but recently, actually.
Yeah, so you had to learn how to ride a bike to ride Ragbri, right?
Yes.
Wow. How was the training process for that?
I was not very straightforward to Mara about my bicycle abilities. I really wanted to be part of Team Shizunan. So I was a little bit arrogant. I said, oh, I climbed 14 mountains, including Everest. I can learn a bike. I was wrong. I needed help. I literally borrowed a bike, grabbed my roommate in Dubai the first time I tried it, in the underground parking lot of my building, because it was very hot and I was too scared to go outside. And I started going around and around slowly on the bike. And then when I went back home to Saudi, I did the same thing in the garden. Well, it's not acceptable for a woman to sit on a bike and go outside publicly, because you have to wear specific clothes to be on the bike, and the clothes don't abide by the cultural norms. So it's not a written rule as much as it's just a no-no. Mm. And that's how I learned. It was slowly getting over my fear of looking like an idiot, which I did at some point, even on Ragbri. But in the end, I really, really wanted to do this. I really wanted to be part of it. So I slowly went from wobbly to a little bit more steady.
I think that's something we really take for granted, you know, as, you know, someone myself who learned to ride a bike at a very young age. You know, I barely even remember learning how to ride a bike, but learning as an adult, I assume, would be much harder.
It was very difficult because you're used to, you drive a car, you're used to doing things correctly. It's ego. You don't want to fall. I'm 29 years old. I didn't want to fall off of a bike. But once you put that aside and really look at yourself and say, am I going to really make a bike get the better of me, get the best of me? And that's how I looked at it. I looked at it as just another challenge. And with a final push that really made me want to ride the whole thing, not just symbolically, was I reminded myself that there are a lot of young girls out there that don't even know how it feels like to wear a medal around their neck. They don't know what it tastes like to stand on top of a mountain or to lift a trophy. And if I had to get over my fear and ego of being on a bicycle will help a girl achieve that or open her eyes to the possibility, then I should just get over it and learn how to ride a bike.
And certainly that's part of it. You know, like you said, being an accidental role model, being a role model for others, you know, besides seeing other people, you know, do what they'd like to do, what kinds of opportunities do you wish existed for young Muslim women in Saudi Arabia and other countries in the Middle East?
I just really wish that we reach a point where whatever her dream is, whichever path she believes she's meant to take, we don't judge her by it, and we don't try to make her fit into the specific box that our culture, and I don't say religion because it's not the religion. It's not. I didn't do anything that opposed my religion. It's a sport. And it's a shame that we're put on such a short leash. We have so many lines because people misunderstand culture and religion. So I really, really hope in my lifetime I reach a point where if she wants to be an astronaut, a pilot, or a mother, it's looked on as the same dream, not one that's male, one that's female, one that, you know what I mean? Like, I really hope this line is completely, we want to remove the stereotype, we want to kill this, we want a generation where if she wants to be a fighter pilot, her dad will say, come, I'll take you, I'll sign you up. I want that mentality to die, because we have such great potential. And if a Saudi woman could stand on top of the world for 15 minutes or however long I was there, then I'm pretty sure other girls are capable to blow my sports career out of the water and do great things.
It took your family, you know, a little time to accept, you know, that you wanted to pursue a career as a mountain climber. Do you know how your story is received in your native country, Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, they're very loud, so I know exactly what they're thinking. In the beginning, when I was in Nepal after I summited, I was oblivious. I had no idea what was going on. I came back down. My phones were all no batteries. When I landed in Saudi and turned on my phone and started getting the both the amazing positive and the really harshly negative, I realized that I did something. Because even if they don't agree with me, and there are a lot of people that don't agree with me because they misunderstand the sport, they think it's very male-dominated, which it is, but they think it's only meant for men. And some people weren't happy with the fact that I wasn't covering my hair, the fact that I was on my own. What's important to me is that these people, even the ones that oppose me, are aware of me. They know that there's a Saudi woman that has done this. So whether they like it or not, I'm in their mind. I'm in their psyche. I don't care if they remember my name. I don't care if they remember anything about me other than that, than there was a Saudi woman out there that did this. Because hopefully one day when he has a daughter and she wants to ride a bicycle, he'll think, okay, so she can ride a bicycle if a Saudi woman did all that. Hopefully. That's what I'm trying to do. So all the negative stuff, and I got a lot of negative stuff for because they just misunderstood what I was trying to do, I hope in the end it turns into something positive at least.
Mm-hmm. And Mara, what did it mean for you and your, you know, former high school classmates to ride with these six international Muslim female athletes? You mentioned at the beginning what you hoped your takeaway was. What did you end up taking away from this experience?
Well, for me, I have to say that when I started with this idea and we decided to recruit elite athletes and adventurers, they put themselves at great risk. When you consider that Raha could not ride a bicycle, and we did laugh about it, the fact that she wasn't straightforward with me. She said she could ride, but she didn't tell me how poorly. You know, then she kept at it. She trained for it. And it was the most remarkable thing because she finished the first day, and it took her a few hours longer than the other athletes. But I think the joy that our team felt when she achieved that was probably the highlight of the full week, because we knew that it was somebody who was in the public. You know, she's known to the public for a certain thing. It was for mountain climbing. We know that she's a professional. She's elite. We knew that she could accomplish that. But for both she, say, Kiran Khan, who's an Olympic swimmer, Mona Siraji, whose specialty is snowboarding and surfing, they actually put their egos aside to attempt something, and not only a bicycle ride, but 7 days across nearly 500 miles. So I just couldn't believe, the level of admiration that I have for them, that they put themselves in that position because they believed that they know that they're role models for the younger generation, and not only the younger generation, but all people, and that they believed in the awareness campaign promoting female sports participation. My friends and I, because again, as I said at the beginning, we always had access to sport. We never had to fight in order to play or to be a spectator. And even that is an issue that in some countries such as Iran, it's illegal for some women to watch men's sporting events. So what we took away from it was just absolutely being inspired from these younger women and really just trying – what we tried to do, my highest priority was to keep them safe because – we knew that they trusted us. They came into this incredible environment of uncertainty that even we didn't know exactly how the Ragbri week would unfold. But they came over, met up with 12 strangers, effectively, and just agreed to be a Team Shirzanon family. So together, I think that we really accomplished a few things to show the power of the sisterhood, you know, how we could bond over a valuable mission. And so I'm just filled with awe, not only for Raha, but the other young women as well.
Without Mara's support and all of the IUNs, I have to say that we came not knowing what to expect, and these ladies were amazing. We fell in love with each and every one of them because they believed in us. And even when I didn't believe in myself, Mara always believed in me. So that just to give you a small glimpse on how beautiful Team Shirzanon was. And they empowered us by believing in our cause. And we don't really get that often when it comes to women in sport. So it's something I will always hold dear, and we're very thankful for it.
Yeah, as are we. You know, the cross-cultural aspect of it was also wonderful because they would ride together and they'd have conversations. So they learned so much about one another. And we had a panel July 17 at Drake University, and we're going to find a way to make that DVD available, because you can really hear from the words of these beautiful athletes the barriers, you know, they've triumphed over gender, cultural, societal, all types of barriers to succeed. And then they came to Iowa not knowing what to expect, and they conquered the humidity, you know, and all kinds of unknowns. It's really quite remarkable, really awe-inspiring.
Will we see Team Shearson on Rag Rye next year?
What do you think, Ra?
Can I get three wheels?
We haven't made that decision just yet, but we had a really wonderful experience, and I think we'll just take it one step at a time. We're still recovering from this first round.
Excuse to meet again. Any excuse. We were talking about one of us getting married or someone. We need any excuse, because that's how beautiful it was. But yes, I really, really hope we get to do something like this again. It was absolutely amazing, really.
We're hoping that we did have a filmmaker, and right now we're in the process of fundraising for a documentary. So if things move along, as I hope, perhaps we'll be reuniting for the premiere. That's our goal. It's a little less strenuous than a bicycle ride.
I'll be there. I have no problem with that. No bicycles, I'll be there.
Right.
Mara Gouvon is an Urbandale native who now lives and works in New York City. Mara, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you very much, Emily.
And Raha Maharik, I hope you enjoyed your time in Iowa. Thank you as well.
Thank you so much for having us.
Well, and Raha, you live in Dubai now. Are you in the States for a few more days?
Yeah, I'm in the States for a bit, trying to get my legs to work normally, and then I'm back to Dubai.
Safe travels, Raha. Thank you again.
Thank you.
And finally today, the state of Iowa says goodbye to the director of the Raptor Resource Project, Bob Anderson. He died on Tuesday. Anderson's internet bird cam of the Decorah Eagles went live in 2011. Almost overnight, the birds became one of the world's largest wildlife education programs. Anderson came on NewsBuzz many times to give us updates on the birds. Here's an interview with him from this January when he talked to Ben Kiefer about the competition over an eagle's nest. Anderson started the conversation by describing the avian intruders.
Well, we've had a pair of great horned owls that have taken a liking to the Decorah eagle nest. The eagles are often in it during the day, but at night it's being visited by a pair of great horned owls. And about a week ago, one of the eagles saw an owl in the nest in the middle of the night, and it went in to chase it away. And then it was actually the mate of that particular owl struck the male bald eagle so hard it knocked it right out of the nest. And all that was captured on video, and it's shocking.
Right.
It's absolutely shocking. Now, this morning I got up, and I can review every 3 hours we've got recorded video, and sure enough, we had an owl in the nest for quite a bit last night.
Right. And so has there been a lot of interest from raptor biologists around the world, I imagine?
You know, there is. There's a lot of interest. There really are. And it's very possible that we might have a Decorah great horned owl cam this year instead of a Decorah bald eagle cam. It's shocking. You know, will we step in and do something? No, we're not. We're just going to let nature work it out and enjoy the ride and learn. And I think a lot of people are quite interested in what's going to transpire, what's going to happen.
Right. We think of a nest. Now, we shouldn't think of a robin's nest here. These are large structures, aren't they?
Yes, this nest is just about 5 feet across in diameter, and it's probably a couple feet deep, so it's quite a large nest. I often describe bald eagle nests as Volkswagens and trees, because they're huge. They're absolutely huge nests.
So you say this is not clear who will, in the end, own this nest, who will inhabit this nest in the coming months. What will determine that? Will it be the first one that lays an egg, perhaps?
That's my guess. Whoever lays the first egg will probably own the nest.
Mm-hmm. What about the homeless raptor? Where do they lay their eggs then?
Well, we don't know. I mean, this pair of bald eagles has two nests. They're about 350 feet apart from each other. Their old nest, after 7 or 8 years, they went off and built another one, which bald eagles do. They routinely build multiple nests. And we're hoping that maybe that one of them, we're hoping that the horned owls go over to the old nest and the bald eagles can keep their nest. I mean, that would be the ideal situation because we have cameras at both trees. So we could, it would make a very exciting decor eagle cam this year if we had both nesting great horned owls and bald eagles. And in fact, there's a film crew from National Geographic that's making a documentary on owls that's really hoping that that happens, is that, that both pairs will nest and they'll be able to get some stunning footage of the interactions between the species.
Okay, Bob Anderson, exciting times at the Raptor Resource Project. Bob Anderson, director of that project, and we'll keep our eyes glued to the internet to find out what is the outcome of this battle between the horned owls and the bald eagles. And we'll put a link to the Eagle Cam on our website. Bob Anderson, thanks again. We'll follow this story.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Ben Kiefer's interview with Bob Anderson from earlier this year. Bob Anderson, director of the Raptor Resource Project, died on Tuesday. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had production assistance today from Dennis Reese, John Pemble, and Sean McLean. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Emily Woodbury. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.